Welcome to Inclusion Unlocked, where we explore the changing equity, diversity and inclusion landscape, bringing you fresh perspectives, lived experiences, practical tips and next practice. I'm Sasha Scott and I'm the founder and CEO of The Inclusive Group. We're an equity, diversity and inclusion consultancy in the business of behaviour. Alongside our guests, we'll be exploring challenging topics and focusing on action, considering the practical steps each of us can take, whether we're leaders, HR practitioners or colleagues, to unlock inclusion in our workplace. So today I'm joined by Professor John Amici, OBE. John is a leading organisational psychologist who set up APS Intelligence back in 2006 to help create effective leaders and authentic cultures. John is also Professor of Leadership at the University of Exeter Business School and a Fellow of the Institute of Science and Technology and a best-selling author of a book called The Promises of Giants. I've been joined by many inspiring guests on Inclusion Unlocked, but the conversation with John is quite possibly the deepest and most inspiring so far. So grab a drink, sit back and relax. This is going to be a good one. John, hi. Thank you so much for joining us on this virtual sofa of Inclusion Unlocked. It's really fabulous to see you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. Looking forward to it.
Well, John, well, first of all, I just want to give anyone that's listening a little bit of context. I have heard and followed you, not going to say stalked, followed you for many years on social media, particularly on LinkedIn. And then a few months ago, I was in British Airways lounge and I saw you. And I was scared, John, because you're a hero to me. But I thought, you know what, if I don't go rush over and say, hello, can I have a photo? I'm going to feel really regret it. So thank you for being so warm and for offering to come and talk to me today. You know, thankfully our worlds collided.
I'm glad they did. No, it's no problem at all. Thank you.
Okay, John. So one of the things I'd love to just jump in with was we share a really deep interest and a background in psychology. And I'm very interested in what drew you to psychology in the first place and how that shapes the work that you do.
I think my mother was a GP, general practitioner, family doctor, and I watched her work fundamentally. I watched her work. I was young enough. And it was a different era, I think, so that I would go on visits with her. I would literally go to the houses of families in distress. Wow. She worked a lot in palliative care, so it would often be to the families of people whose distress was that their family member was going to pass away. And I would sit and watch how she dealt with I never saw how she dealt with the actual sick person because they were always upstairs in another room. But I watched how she dealt with family members and the skills that she deployed, even as I didn't understand them as a young child, as a 7 or 8 year old. But I watched what she did and recognized that she was doing something quite purposeful to ease the pain of people in profound discomfort, in distress, in a way that I hoped never to understand. And that was what drew me to psychology. Some part of it is watching her do this thing that was so clearly valuable, but also some part of having a power like hers to change how people felt and thought, which I thought was compelling. But that was it. It was that kind of childish and naive at the beginning.
That's amazing, because it just makes me feel about how high her empathy must consistently have been in those environments and how skilled she must have been around her interpersonal skills of connecting with everybody. Because I guess if you're a GP, from my understanding, you're going to meet everybody in different situations, but stressful situations.
And she did. She met the whole world. You know, she was a GP in Stockport, Cheadle, Heal Green. And so it did have its lovely, lush, posh bits with older, wealthier families or couples, but it also had its what was at that time newer immigrant populations and groups of people who were just coming together, were just, well, not known by lots of us, I think, at that time, even as we were potentially considered a newer immigrant population. But yeah, she was, it wasn't as warm and fuzzy, perhaps, as people might imagine. My mother was a deeply pragmatic woman, as am I, a deeply pragmatic person. And she levered these tools that she had in a way that didn't feel in any way soft and flourishy, but rather was pragmatically. She was the nourishing, if not always enjoyable, bowl of soup, as opposed to some kind of magical, biscuit flavored elixir.
I love that. I love that. But being a nourishing bowl of soup is incredibly important when people are feeling in a hunger, really, for advice, support.
Yeah, I think often recognizing that it's not just the person you're talking to, but perhaps the connections to them that are dealing with the seismic impacts of something distressing or difficult, traumatic, is an important part of it. And my mother was always really mindful of how the impact of this one thing that was happening to one person could bounce around to others, whether it was one member of the family doing their exams and the impact that might have on other kids, other children, or whether it's an illness or a setback in the career of a person that she's dealing with, and how that might have tangential impacts or important ramifications for others. She was very mindful of all of that.
That's really interesting because it makes me think about toxicity in a space. So if we think about, something that's close to my heart, and I know, you're incredibly involved in this, when we encounter toxic work environments, the impact that one individual can have on an entire team or even bigger is very profound, isn't it?
It is indeed. I mean, part of the challenge with poor behavior, non-optimal behavior, or toxic behavior, if it becomes that, because it's not, it doesn't just start at when the behavior is toxic. It starts at when the behavior is non-optimal. It'll always have a ramification to others. It'll always have an impact on other people, which I think is not taken for granted. Well, clearly, people don't take it for granted. Don't imagine that to be the case, because we allow people who exhibit those non-optimal behaviors to operate, right? We weigh up their potential P&L value versus against the damage that they might be doing to other people. But yeah, it's there's always, workplaces are interconnected systems. They're like little ecosystems. So it's foolish to imagine that pouring oil into a pool at some distant point in an organization wouldn't have a knock-on impact on other elements of the ecosystem somewhere else. And that's how I consider it. It's, in any given environment, if you drop a tiger into a petting zoo, you can't just imagine that, oh, this could have some impacts for that one small. No. This thing is going to ravish across your petting zoo, and it doesn't matter what small perfunctory little paper fences you put up, that thing is going to destroy, because that's what it does. And we need to recognize that more in workplaces, the interconnectedness of the ecosystem, and how one seemingly unrelated behavior over here will have a massive impact somewhere else.
Absolutely. And are we seeing a change? Are we seeing a change? Because we noticed from, compliance angle and a litigation angle and a focus sort of generally on many organizations to get their house in order. And I'm wondering, do you actually see a change around these behaviors and around cultures? Are cultures becoming more inclusive?
It's hard to give a definitive across the board answer to that question. So there is a greater compliance recognition now than there used to be, but compliance is a very low bar for human beings, right? we talk all the time about the fact that being able to leave, being able to create a workplace where people leave at the end of the day and they sit across the apocryphal dinner table, not that many of us sit across the table with our entire family nowadays or have the opportunity to, but they sit across from this kind of mythical dinner table around their family and loved ones collected and say, what a relief today that no one did anything illegal to me. No one says that.
Yes.
But that is what the compliance approach is. The compliance approach is we cannot be sued or we are not technically liable because no one did anything illegal. And that's not the point. The point is high performance. The point isn't, by the way, even just being nice or pleasant. Even if you're just a totally ruthless mercenary of a person who wants to squeeze out every possible component of performance, then what you say is it's not really about niceness there either. It's how can people perform at their best? Well, one of the ways we know that is not simply by making this a place where no one does harm to you, but rather by people actively doing things that enhance your ability to be brilliant, that reduce the impediments of distraction around you, that stop you from having to use parts of your energy to protect your identity or to protect your psychology or to protect your difference in some way. That energy instead is directed towards performance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that instance of covering and the energy usage of trying to assimilate and fit in is just completely exhausting. So I see exactly what you're saying, that it's the incorrect lens to look at. What we should be saying is how can we create work environments, systems, ecosystems where people genuinely thrive?
That's exactly it. That is the question. How can we create places where incredibly incremental, tiny parts of your energy are ever required to defeat a distraction? And most of those distractions will be non-work related. You know, it will be, unfortunately, things like the poor interaction you have coming to or from work on a public transport, right? It will be somebody in your family is sick or unwell or something else. It'll be those things which are significant. But even there, the way that the workplace can operate is to ameliorate those by saying, what are you doing in work today? Yeah, we really need you. Yes, you are unbelievably brilliant. Yes, this meeting will not go as well without you. But what are you doing here right now? Or do you need to leave earlier? Or can we support you in some other way? And all of this is not in service of niceness. This is in service of sustainable high performance. Because when somebody realizes that this is not your family, and if you've read anything that I ever say, you know that I'm highly skeptical of workplaces that call themselves family. But when you make it clear to the people who work with you, this is not your family. Whatever wonderful, odd, complex, unusual thing you have going on at your house, that's what we respect as your family. And you should be there if your child is sick, if something else has gone on. And it's not this in service of niceness. It's in service of the fact that we're going to need you one day, really need you at a point where you can offer it. And you're more likely to give us everything you've got, knowing that when we recognized you needed something else, we gave you that flexibility, that opportunity. So the high performance environment is very much like that. It's recognizing that people are whole human beings that come to work with a world of life that we can't possibly conceive of. And it's not enough to offer them a gym membership or a bloody sleep pod as an alternative. What's important is that you instead accommodate as possible to the lives of people, knowing it's not always possible, but accommodate as possible to the lives of people so that they can focus their whole energy on being utterly brilliant.
So I see that, John, as a compassionate, empathic space. Is that too soft? Because there's compassion in what you've said that optimizes that person, that doesn't drain the energy.
I don't know. I mean, I am not that, right? I am interested in human thriving. But warm and fuzzy, I am not. I am robust, is what I am. I expect people to, when they are with me, working with me, to be focused and deliver optimally. I will have a very clear assessment of the skills and abilities of the people around me in a very short period of time. And my expectation is that, barring information that tells me about another distraction or problem, what they'll deliver to me is always top quality. They'll never give me a document that's ill thought through. They'll never present me with something that has got thoughtless mistakes or errors. They'll show up on time and deliver robustly. That's what I'll expect. So that's the challenge that I make to people. I just recognize that they're also human beings. And so what I will notice is if you show up in a meeting and I look at you and there's something wrong, and I can tell there's something wrong, and I'll always be able to tell there's something wrong because I'm connected to my people. And not this is not about we're all best friends. It's just that we're connected authentically, and I can tell the difference between you on your optimal days and you when you're not. And I'll respond appropriately to that. This idea that, when you're unwell or sick or something else, we had somebody who tried to work while they were sick, and it's just like, what are you doing? Yes, what you're doing is invaluable. Yes, you're the only person who can do it, but what are you doing? If we were interested in having you for the next 6 weeks, then this would be a smart course of action. If you were interested in working here for the next 6 weeks only, then what you're doing would be the right course of action. Fight through. But if we're interested in having you for the next 3 years, a reasonable time to appreciate having somebody in a workplace, right? Being realistic, then this week is just not the week to kill yourself. And it's not warmth and compassion. It's simply very pragmatic. I want you for the long term at the highest possible levels. And there will come a time when I need you to do something above and beyond. And today isn't that day. Because you've had a concussion, because you've had strep throat, because you've been up all night with your kid. Today is not the day. But there will come a day. But why press yourself into pieces on the day that doesn't require it? So it's a very pragmatic approach to this. And I think it's important we say this because it's nobody who works with me thinks that I am anything other than incredibly demanding, incredibly robust in my expectations of perfection. If we agree to a format, for example, my diary is a thing of beauty, right? It's like somebody has created Tetris in the 7 days of my week, and everything is scheduled, and the way things are denoted, they matter to me. And if you make a mistake in that, I will notice and it will be a problem. And I'm talking about if we agree that it's an arrow with one stalk on it with no space, then that's what it'll be because I'm super pedantic about this. And so that level of that's how much I demand people pay attention to detail. So it would be a mistake to think that it's like this wonderful carpet ride when actually it's this deeply robust, authentically connected space where I'm going to expect the highest of you. Just I'm going to recognize that high performance shouldn't have a body count, which I think is the lowest of bars, right?
The
Work
lowest.
shouldn't kill you. Work shouldn't wound you in a way that is enduring and unfixable. Work shouldn't require that parts of your life crumble in order to do it well. I just don't think that's like a super high bar.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. And I suspect that there is an enormous amount of respect in your work environment between people. And candid conversations, because that's how stuff gets done and people get messages as well, right? Going back to my script, because I've gone off script and I'm not sure that was like the best idea. We're talking with a backdrop of massive hostility and politicization and polarization in workspaces, as in society, as in workspaces being a reflection of society. When we think about leaders in work environments, given the backdrop, given the geopolitics, given this whole sort of throw DEI under the bus, go woke, go broke, how How can they navigate this? What advice do you have for people, John, who genuinely care about why inclusion, diversity, equity, justice is fundamental?
So there isn't very much truth to the idea that you go woke, you go broke. There isn't very much evidence for it. People do keep talking about it, and I don't know. Somebody told me it was the case with electric vehicles that Ford has got an electric vehicle, electric truck, and it's nothing to do with wokeness. And I didn't think electric vehicles had anything to do with being woke either, but. So you can see how it's really the misuse of the word woke that's the problem there, as opposed to anything else. So this is what I'd say to people. There's 35 years worth of meta-analysis and analysis that tells us that diverse and inclusive environments, not just diverse and not just inclusive, but diverse and inclusive environments are good for business in any number of dimensions. And again, there's massive amounts of evidence of this, and which is why in any of the work that we do not acknowledge, nor do we engage in the debate about the business case, because it's stupid. It's just stupid. We know the answer to that question. That answer is over. Gravity is not just a theory, it is real. The Earth is not flat. Climate change is real, and human beings account for it, and diverse and inclusive business organizations, and indeed organizations broadly, thrive better than others, especially in times of disruption, which is what we're dealing with now. So just there's nothing really for you to believe about this. It is simply an acknowledgement of what we know to be true. The second thing is that the ship has sailed for the business leaders out there who are worried about, not worried about that. What they're hoping is that it'll all just go back to how it was, right? People will embrace an 8 until 6 work culture again. They'll embrace work as family and instead of family. They'll embrace being in co-located in an office all at once every day. And the ship has sailed. It's over. And you lost, if that's the perspective you took. You lost. And if you're a leader who thinks, and I talk about this a lot, the leaders who think that the present is attached by a bungee cord to the past, and if they can just hold out long enough, eventually, snap, it'll be 1980 and Gordon Gekko all over again. And it won't, because the ship has sailed. If they think that women will stop fussing about whether I touch her on the shoulder or pat her on the bum, and we'll go back to those times. It's over. If you're thinking your black and brown colleagues will be fine with you not learning how to pronounce their names and just calling them Charlie instead, it's over. If you think your queer colleagues will think it's okay for you to malign or say terrible things about them, it's over. And it won't matter what the law says in your jurisdiction, it's over. This would seem like a Western view, except that most organizations are now global, and all you have to do is go on their websites and read what they say. And what they say is it's over. So all you're doing is setting yourself up for failure by creating an incongruence, a gap between what you're promising on your own website and what you plan on delivering over time. If you're interested, it's worth bearing in mind that the data tells us that the expectations of leaders have shifted and shifted radically, and it's nothing to do with the pandemic. It is not because of the pandemic. This shift has been happening for a long time. I can show you a thing if you're interested. We asked
Definitely.
a group of leaders, what were the qualities, the criteria that really made a difference for them when they were first brought into leadership. What were the qualities that mattered? What were the things they said that mattered? And this is what they said. They said confidence, charisma, experience. Notice male and how prominent it is, right?
Yes.
So this stuff and qualifications and certainty and assertiveness. This is what they said. But then we asked this, and by the way, this is a group of leaders. They were crusty old people like me, and we because most of the leaders still in business are older folk in business. So this is C-suite executives from across six countries.
Right.
What do you think makes a leader? And this is what they said. And then, well, what are the qualities now? And I was at pains to tell them, not since the pandemic, not because of the pandemic, but now because of the omni crisis we're living in. Now because we've got wars, or at least conflicts in different countries. Now because we've got socio-political and other upheaval. Now because we have regulatory realignment and commercial and economic challenges. Things like Brexit and on, right?
Yeah.
Now, what kind of leadership do we require? Now, what kind of leadership do we require now in a world where, according to McKinsey, somewhere between 75 and 375 million job roles globally are going to shift between 2016 and 2030? And in that environment where learning is going to be important, agility is going to be important, what kind of things are required from leaders? And they said this. The same group of people,
Gosh.
vision, empathy, flexibility, accountability is still in there. So it's not that this has lost all robustness and no more is it important, but adaptability, inclusivity, compassion, vision, this idea that you can see a different kind of future. So this is it, and it's over. It's over. Because if you look on people's websites, that first picture I showed you
Yes.
is not what's reflected in people's websites today. What's reflected in people's websites today is that second picture. So
Wow.
we've acknowledged it's over. We've simply not accepted the consequence of that, which is that if you think vision and empathy and accountability and feedback and compassion and empathy are important, then there are a set of skills and criteria that leaders and indeed colleagues must have to be able to deliver that. It's the what needs to be true. And we need to know what part of our job, what part of what we do at APS Intelligence is to help people to not according to us and what we think is important, but according to their own promises, their own websites, their own policies and procedures, what needs to be true in terms of the logistics of your organization and in terms of the interpersonal skills and the leadership skills of your organization to make those promises true. Most organizations don't. The connection between comms people and marketing and the inner organization is not always as tight as it should be. So people don't realize that when you put on like a common message on a website is something like your manager will take an interest in your career. And people don't realize that when that sentence exists, there's a cascade of implications for it. If you've got a utilization culture in your company, your manager will take an interest in career. Nobody who reads that thinks it means once a year appraisal or twice a year appraisal. They think it means a coaching conversation once a month. And it doesn't mean to be an hour, but by an interested person who is requisitely skilled to deliver that coaching session. And in that coaching session being delivered not by an external coach, but by your manager who has those skills to have that. That sentence, your manager takes an interest in career, means if I'm in your team, and I tell you, I'm really valuable to you, but I'm telling you that for me to stay in this organization, I need something new. You have to be willing to inconvenience yourself to help make that happen, as is practical. So that's what we have to do. And if you're a leader in this world worried about is all this wokeness or whatever else and empathy, warm and soft, no, it's about performance and it's about delivering on the promises you've already made.
And John, when I look at that second visual, the empathy word was shouting out at me, going back to your Mar, actually. But full circle, one of the things that we often get asked is how do you help leaders become more empathic? Let's even forget the leader thing. Can we encourage empathy in other people? Is that a skill that can be developed in somebody else, or is that innate to you or I? Is this just something I think I'm quite empathic? Is it something that can be taught, developed? What's your view?
Yeah, I think the literature is fairly clear on this. I say fairly clear. It's pretty unequivocal that empathy in the context of workplaces, right? Because it's not just about do you cry at sad films. This is about a set of skills that you can have or can develop, right? So we are talking about things like reflex inhibition is a empathetic skill. This is a emotional literacy skill. Reflex inhibition is the ability for a person to not do the thing that they are first tempted to do in response to another person. We teach it to children, right?
Yeah.
It's the, oh, your friend made you mad because they wouldn't share their biscuit with you. Oh, you hit them. Now, is that right to hit them? Well, I was so frustrated and it made me so angry, and they're supposed to be my friend. And we teach them, use your words, right? We teach them. So
Not your hands.
how
Yeah.
else can you talk about what it is that's
Yeah.
and as an adult, we have these same things where we're saying, oh, I have told you 3 times not to do this process this way and to do it this way. And what I want to do right now, because it makes me feel better, is in front of this group of collected people on Teams, I want to yell at you. Not so that you can learn, but so that I can humiliate you for the pain that I now feel because something you've done has gone wrong. And instead, that ability to change that is a real skill. So you can teach that. Just as we teach children, we can teach ourselves in an adult context, peer to peer, to do that. It's emotional regulation, which is different than what I've just been talking about, because that's about yourself. The other one, emotional regulation, is the idea that I can use my presence to raise and lower the temperature of a room. I can use my purposefully use my voice and my presence, my intention to bring a room that's not really engaged in, to see someone over there who doesn't know that they can contribute, or to see somebody here who's contributing too much. I say, really, Sasha, great to hear from you. Bear with me a second. I'd really like to hear from John first. I know you've got some great stuff. It's that ability to
Okay.
raise or lower. It's the ability when people come in and they've heard about your organizational transformation happening and everybody is scared, to
Yeah.
tell them almost nothing, because you often know nothing, but to say, I understand that you are scared. Here's how we're going to proceed. The world is not going to collapse today. There could be difficult times ahead, but this is what we're going to do together to manage through this. This is what gives us the best chance of thriving as we move forward, and indeed the best chance for each of us to manage through this transformation. And it's the ability to keep the temperature of the room in a place that isn't so fraught that nothing productive can be done. And that's another skill that you can have. So the ability to tell when people are different than normal. When you see somebody and it's like, I have observed you over X number of weeks or months, and you are normally in this space, in this context. And
Right.
today you're in a different space in this context. And it's just a set of skills. We often use scripts and tools rather than asking people to be spontaneously brilliant. So things like, Sasha, I just want to say that I've noticed a difference in you today. I may not be the person you want to talk to about this, and I do not demand it, but I wanted you to know that I noticed. And if I can help, I'd love for you to tell me how.
Yeah.
And that
Yeah.
doesn't mean I can promise you everything. It doesn't mean I can tell you to go home today already, depending on the circumstance. It doesn't mean that I can offer you anything that will change what's going on in your life if your dog or your pet is sick. I can't do anything about that directly, but what I can do is at least acknowledge that this thing has had a legitimate impact on you. So there's so many of these, but they're all just skills. That's all they are. They're certainly easier to learn than how to properly use Excel. They're certainly easier to learn than how to utilize all the shortcuts in Word. So that's the thing that boggles my mind, really. It's so simple. What they are is incredibly energy expensive. To do this costs a lot of energy. I am naturally quite Teutonic. I live at a, I don't know how you'd characterize it, but I'm quite flat. But
Okay.
I recognize that that is not good for everybody. And so when people meet me, I am generally more than that,
Right.
because I think that's a way that I can help people. I raise my temperature to
Yes.
help people engage with me in a way that makes it feel like it's appropriately warm. Whereas
Yeah.
normally I would have my headphones in and disappear into my own world in a way that would be unhelpful for others. And it's a small accommodation. It doesn't take many skills, but it is energy expensive.
Okay, that's fascinating because it also links with something that I've heard you talk quite a lot around introversion and extreme. You describe yourself as an extreme introvert. And given that there are so many people who are introverted in the workplace, well, in society, in life, how can workplaces I don't want to say accommodate because it's not accommodate. It's appreciate, it's create that environment that people can thrive that are not the extrovert, the salesperson, the shouty person, but because for me, true inclusion is where we all thrive through our diversity. And I'd just love to understand more around the introversion space. And then I want to tell you a story around that.
So the introversion, I think it's important that people recognize that nobody should tell you who you are, right?
Okay.
Everybody who's ever heard me talk knows that I think that personality testing is mostly bollocks,
Yeah.
and there's really good data to back that up. The idea that it's mostly, as an introspective tool, I've no issue with it. But just because you've been told you are four letters or a primary color, doesn't mean you should believe that. And you certainly shouldn't believe that it's encapsulated all that you have. So my version of extreme introversion is that I find human beings and the presence of human beings in a space near me energy expensive. That includes being on the tube or on the train. It includes all of these things. It includes walking in the street, which is why I don't mostly. And when I do, I walk with my headphones in with purpose in order to get to a place where there aren't human beings. And it's not because I don't like people. That's not the point. It is simply that every interaction with other people takes a bit of energy. It's like it's an attritional effect, and it's completely worth it,
Yeah.
right? My interactions with other human beings are invariably completely worth it, and I, in a sense, enjoy them despite the fact that I can feel my battery being drained in the process, right? So don't mistake what this is. That's how complex introversion is for people. But extroversion is equally complex for people because for them, when they don't get enough energy from somebody, they do recognize and understand why not. But it drains their battery too to not get that kind of robust, measured equal energy back. And it's not even that all extroverts want to be loud and all introverts want to be quiet. It really is about the energy exchange more often than that, because lots of introverts can give great speeches and lots of extroverts can't give great speeches. So it's not about your presentation skills per se. Workplaces that recognize these intrinsic differences, cognitive and psychological, emotional differences, they demand that everybody flexes. That's what they do. So it's
Yeah.
not about an accommodation, as you pointed out. Everybody flexes. So when I enter a meeting, especially a team meeting for all of us that we have on Monday, for example, then I am more in that meeting on purpose. It's a Monday. Not everybody loves Mondays. I happen to, but I want everybody to know that I am super engaged and present and here and just a bit more. It's not an act. It is because I believe this is what this group of people who are a mixture of introverts and extroverts demand and deserve from me as one of the leaders in the organization. That is what I do. I accommodate. When somebody comes to me and they say, I've got a great idea, I don't really want to raise it on my own in this meeting, I say, that's fine. Give me a 2-minute summary right now, and often even less than that. I'll just say, I'm going to just float a little bit of my credibility out there. And I'll say, in this meeting full of, let's assume, all these high-powered people, and say oh, actually, my colleague Sasha and I were talking about this earlier. Sasha, could you just talk a bit about what we were discussing? Now, just a tiny bit of energy is conferred, and it's a bit of energy to kind of get the room to where you want it to be, and then point it over there. And it's not that you needed anything more than that, but there's a little, and your deference, your kind of flex in that moment is the idea that even though perhaps speaking in front of a group isn't your favorite thing and is a bit energy expensive, you bring yourself to that. And so everybody's flexed a little bit to make that delivery happen, to allow your expertise to shine. your flex as an extrovert in the room is that somebody's presenting to you and you want to bounce into that. It's probably not just extroversion, but somebody who's really keen. You want to bounce in, and it's 2 minutes into the presentation, you want to start asking questions. And your commitment to it is putting yourself on mute and giving that person 6 minutes to get their idea out in full, and then sticking your hand up so that you don't interrupt, to make sure that you can ask a question at the right time. Each of us, if we flex, and this is why good meetings are energy expensive, because everybody is just mindful of how they can behave in order for the whole to operate better. And that's what it's about in workplaces. What tiny accommodations can you make instead of saying, you know what, this is the way I like to do it. This is a free for all. This room is a frenzy. If you want your idea in, you've got to be the loudest, go out there and do it. Because that to me is the cruelty, the tyranny of bad ideas comes from that. Because there's bunches of people who'll never get a chance to bring their idea, or whose idea will be eviscerated before you get a chance to see the value in it. Yeah.
Wow.
Flexing and accommodation.
And those are great takeaways from today. They're really great. Really, really great. The little story I wanted to share, which has really got me thinking, was yesterday I read an interview where someone, a self-proclaimed introvert, talked about how, despite that, and the fact energy was sapped from them when they were in big public environments, they ended up being a diplomat, traveled the world. They liked London because they spent a lot of time alone in cars in the traffic, something we can both resonate to. But they also developed a scheme for dealing with big rooms. And one of the things was they went with a couple of really great questions. And one of the questions was, John, how do you visualize time?
How do you visualize time? I don't know if I ever have visualized time, except to acknowledge how finite it is. That's the piece. Because it's a very esoteric thing for me, that I'd have to wrap my head around it several times before coming up with something truly cogent. But when people talk to me about esoteric things like time, my mind is deeply pragmatic. And what I want to do is make it pragmatic. And the pragmatic thing I can tell everybody about time is that it is shorter than you'd imagine. That it, like an hourglass, is always running out. And all of us assume that our hourglass is one of those big ones you can barely lift, that sits on a shelf and was turned the day that you were born and has not moved since. Rather than imagining that it is significantly smaller than that, and that movement around it impacts how fast or slow the time runs, and that at any moment the last grain could fall, and how do you make sure that you're in the right place when that happens?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. 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 John, this for me has been an extraordinary conversation, and I'm so deeply grateful, and I really, really mean that, because I'm sure it's expended a lot of energy, and it is going to bring joy, curiosity, reflection, I know, to anybody that listens to it who are properly listening to it. So thank you so much from me.
It is my pleasure and entirely worth it. Thank you.
Wow. I'm incredibly grateful to John for giving his time so generously and for sharing such profound and thought-provoking insights with us. And of course, if you'd like to learn more about Inclusive Group and how we can help your organisation drive real change, I would love to hear from you. To find out more about what we do or arrange a conversation, click on the link on the landing page of this episode and follow through to our website.